Hello and welcome to Enlighten My Loafers. I'm Brett White, and I'm here to break down the basics and the complexes of personal style. See what I did there? By day, I am a pop culture reporter for Decider. By night, I'm someone that watches a lot of Project Runway and RuPaul's Drag Race. But right now, I am seeking to find out a lot more about the world of clothes and style because I want to up my game and I want to help all of you do the exact same. And while I may not know a lot, my guest this week, Jesse Thorne, knows a lot about this stuff. He's the founder of the Maximum Fun Podcast Network, the host of Bullseye, co-host of Jordan Jesse Go, the bailiff on Judge John Hodgman, and most relevant to this here podcast, the founder of Put This On, a fantastic website that is a great resource for people that want to know kind of anything about clothes, style, the history of fashion, etc., etc. In this episode, we talk about the origins of Put This On, the ins and outs of vintage shopping, and we touch on politics because it's the first episode and I got some really existential questions about kind of the entire nature of this podcast, and I really figured there was no one better to talk to than Jesse Thorne, who is such a smart, thoughtful, and funny guy who thinks about all this stuff either in a way that I already do or in a way that I want to. So I was very happy to get to learn from him this time. Are you ready to hear what Jesse has to teach me this week? Let's go! Founder of Maximum Fun and Put This On. Am I leaving anything out?
Yeah, probably. I just have one of those things that says father of three and some other stuff.
That's what the Twitter bio is.
Yeah, like a congressperson has. And you're like, come on, you're also a congressperson.
You're also doing some important stuff. Well, I want to just go on and jump right in. What is your history with clothing? Like, why? The big question, I guess, is why clothes?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been an interest of mine my whole life. My mother is very clothing oriented. When I was a kid, she was a weaver for a time and a textile conservator. And she used to make my clothes when I was very little.
Oh, wow.
And she also used to work in a shop on Fillmore Street in San Francisco, which at the time, one or two of these is still left, but at the time had a bunch of very fancy thrift stores. So a lot of my clothes would come from those very fancy thrift stores that people who lived in Pacific Heights, a Tony neighborhood in San Francisco, would donate their kids' clothes to. Ooh. So it was always an interest. And, you know, it's gone through, you know, there are many versions of it. It's not like I was, as my colleague John Hodgman, I gather, did, walking around high school with a briefcase.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was certainly always an interest. And, you know, by the time I got to high school, I went to arts high school. So there was really no type of dressing that would have been considered weird. Like at the point where you have multiple classmates who only wear vinyl.
Yeah.
there's nothing you can do that will scandalize anyone.
Well, what happened after you're like, did that alter your brand, like when you got, you know, turned 18, got into like the real working world? Were you shocked of like, wait, people are wearing fabric that isn't vinyl out here?
People, even at UC Santa Cruz, where I went to college, definitely people thought I was a little outrageous. And maybe I was. I remember people were mad at me because I used to have a boombox.
Oh, whoa.
And in college, and people were mad at me. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, like, I don't know. I'm from the hood. We all had them. I don't know what is the beef here.
Well, when you say you had a boombox, you mean you carried it around with you, like Say Anything style?
Yeah.
Or oh, wow.
Well, I wouldn't characterize it as Say Anything style. I might say more like Radio Raheem style.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. So, you know, I was walking around listening to Black Star or whatever, you know. So, yeah, definitely was a lot. And I think in terms of getting into tailored clothing, particularly. And I've never been a super fashion person.
Right.
In terms of, you know, runway fashion. But in terms of getting into tailored clothing, I think when I grew up, I ended up going into business for myself. And I think having that as, you know, having that little point of formality helped, you know, went along with things like writing professional emails and so forth,
right,
and making people feel comfortable that I was doing a real thing, even though actually I was just a guy in the foyer of my apartment in Koreatown.
Yeah.
You know, and like convincing guests, hopefully, that I wasn't going to murder them or, you know, other people that I was an actual legitimate business person when I think it could be argued that I was not.
Well, it's like it's dressing for the job that you have and how you should dress for it, I guess. So you put people at ease. Yeah.
Yeah, I was. Yeah, dressing for. I also should mention that I wanted to be an astronaut and I wore a spacesuit most of the time. That was more of a dress for the job you want.
Right. Then, yeah. Well, so when did Put This On come about? Like, what was the impetus? What was the inciting incident to be like, well, I actually want to write about this. I want to make a video about this.
Video was the first thing. What happened essentially was in, you know, 2008 or something like that. Probably 10 years ago, I had been podcasting for quite some time by then and had a little bit of success in the context of podcasting, but still was, yeah, I mean, certainly was, still would characterize myself as impoverished. And I made friends with this guy, Adam Lissagore, who was also a very successful podcaster. He was one of the hosts and the producer of a podcast called You Look Nice Today that was a very early successful comedy podcast and a very brilliant show.
Listeners might recognize him as the True Car spokesman, or
yeah, he is the True Car spokesman.
Is it True Car? It's one of
those.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
It is True Car. Yeah, he's totally the spokesperson for True Car, or the spokesperson for 1,000 internet startups.
Right.
So basically, what happened is I knew Adam was a filmmaker, and I knew he was really funny, and I knew from his editing on You Look Nice Today, and also from a pledge drive video that he had made for me just because he offered, because he liked my show, what a gifted comic filmmaker he was, but that he was also able to make something pretty. And that's a very rare combination of skills that in the years since has made him a very rich man. At the time he was working as an editor at a post-production company, and his most recent big credit was operating the Predator cam in one of the Alien versus Predator movies. He was the only camera operator around who was small enough to fit in the suit, but good enough to operate the camera, but was not in the DP union, which would not allow anyone in the DP union to get into the Predator suit.
Oh God.
That's
man.
My understanding.
That's so a gig. That's a good gig.
So one day we were at the dog park, he with his dog Diggy and me with my dog Coco. And I said, hey, I've been wanting to do something about fashion, but I don't know that a podcast is going to be the right medium. I'd like to have a visual element, no offense. And I was like, would you try making a video with me? And I had also recently met some people from Kickstarter, which at the time was very early in its beta.
Yeah.
And we raised $1,500, I think, to make the first one. And then we raised a few thousand to make the next few. And I wanted somewhere for the videos to live so that people would come to look at them back when people looked at blogs and websites. And so I started a blog and I used Tumblr because I had heard it was good. And very soon, almost immediately, the blog became more successful than the videos.
Well, this is also like, this is peak Tumblr time too. Like 10 years ago, it's very like Tumblr was the hot new thing.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. And, you know, we ended up with many hundreds of thousands of Tumblr followers. And yeah, it kind of went from there. Like I started looking for ways to make money. People were asking me if they could advertise on the site and I started hiring people. And, you know, it's still very much a going concern all these years later, despite the fact that no one looks at blogs anymore.
Well, now it's on Twitter, and I find links to Put This On by following Put This On Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and I met Adam Lissagore on Twitter, so there you go.
It's all circle.
When people would be, when you'd have to explain that it was like your AOL instant messenger away message.
Yeah. The reason I find Put This On so cool and interesting is that it talks about clothes in a very, I don't know, usually a lot of fashion stuff, you have the assumption that it is stuffy, upper class, ritzy, highfalutin stuff. I mean, I'm from the South, so, you know, we don't talk about our clothes that much down there. But Put This On has such a very nice, forward, like, fun and practical slant to it? I didn't know, like, how did you develop the voice of Put This On?
Well, I think it's mostly just my voice.
Right.
I think the, I mean, these days it's Derek's voice, but Derek also, who edits the blog, but he also, you know, has adapted to the editorial voice of Put This On. I mean, I think there are a couple of factors. One is I'm born and raised in San Francisco. My parents are college educated sophisticates, but I grew up pretty poor. And in that context, clothing did not have the cultural baggage that it has in some parts of the United States.
Right, yeah.
Like, I didn't know any preps. You know what I mean? What the fuck is that? It was my position. And when people would start to explain to me about, like, guys named Chad, I was like, they really do that? That's not just, like, a joke from movies?
They pop all the collars?
Like, yeah, exactly. And, like, you know, so, and I grew up kind of, I kind of grew up between worlds, you know, like the most strictly enforced uniforms in the neighborhoods that I grew up in were like press Ben Davis khakis and red or blue t-shirts with red and white or blue and white Nike Cortezes, which were kind of the cholo uniforms of the Norteños and Sureños that were the primary gangs in the neighborhood that I grew up in. And, you know, like I wasn't going to wear that. I was very happy to assert my white privilege of not being assumed to be flying colors anytime,
yeah.
Or set tripping anytime in the neighborhood. So you just had to deal with the, you know, hey, white boy stuff.
Yeah.
But I think in general, I had a relatively irreverent perspective on it. That is to say, not like jokey, but just I wasn't too hung up on the class issues or so on and so forth. And I also was raised by a mother in particular. My mother is now a retired college professor, but also, you know, worked in retail for much of my childhood and was an antique dealer for much of my childhood. And like, I just grew up always with the expectation that aesthetics were important, that beauty was important, and that clothes were part of that. So without any idea of seeking social status or whatever. And then I also, my educational background and also my mother's for that matter is in American studies and culture studies. So, and Derek, who's the editor, is a sociologist. And you know, that has always been a big piece of it.
Right. He just wrote that piece about the history of Ivy style, right?
Yeah. And you know, Derek really, he uses a pen name for writing about fashion because he doesn't want a sociologist to Google his real name and find that he spent the last 5 years writing about fashion and not some specific sociology thing that whatever academic sociologists are into. So it was sort of a combination of those things, right? It was like it was a sincere interest in clothing particularly. And fashion to some extent, but clothing particularly, and the aesthetics of clothing and the cultural values of clothing that came from someone who did not grow up in a particularly prescribed aesthetic lane.
Yeah.
And when we created the thing, I was like, I hate most fashion magazines. I mean, no offense to them. There's the good things in them. But they're basically just... They're venues for advertising, you know,
yeah.
Like they're exclusively venues for advertising.
The first 100 pages in any fashion magazine is just advertising.
Yeah. And the content is they're pretty open about the deep interrelationship. And I found that offensive.
Right.
I wanted something that was not just like trying to make you feel bad for being poor. And I wanted something that was neither a magical world where everyone is rich and everything is aspirational and everything is on a fucking yacht or whatever. And everybody smokes cigars and drinks really expensive whiskey and all
right.
these dudes things that to me, I just associate with assholes.
Yeah. That's what Instagram is. And it's
really
a hole
exhausting.
You fall down. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also didn't want to be the other thing, which is what I would call, broadly speaking, a beer commercial.
yeah.
Which is to say, like, guys, are you sick of chicks telling you how to dress?
Head down to your man cave and slap on a flannel. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I think that we got lucky. I got lucky that in some ways, well, for one thing, we were in early. And for another thing, my tastes, which tend towards the relatively classic and tend towards quality and welcome, you know, secondhand goods and so on and so forth, all those things had a, you know, had a lovely renaissance that coincided with the economy collapsing. but also with the values of, you know, I'm a very old millennial, and I think millennial values, maligned though they are for some reason, coincided with, like, people wanting something that was nice and good and wanting to understand value systems that the baby boomers had rejected out of hand.
Yeah.
Simply because they were busy rejecting everything.
Yeah.
Except for self-indulgence.
Well, I love that answer that kind of touched upon one of the main concerns. I don't know. This is more like a psychology thing for me. That by caring about what I am wearing, by, you know, by taking selfies or by, like, liking putting together outfits, that it feels artificial or self-indulgent instead of, like, the self-care that it kind of is. And I feel like it's partly because the yacht, cigar smoking,
yeah,
probably, like, old money Republican, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm trying to, like, divorce those two notions in my mind. And I don't know, Put This On does a really good job of doing that.
Yeah. I mean, for me, like, if you ask me, oh, like, who is your fashion hero?
Who is your fashion hero? I would like to know.
Probably Andre 3000.
Amazing. Yeah.
Like, I'm one of those people who relates to both Andre 3000 dressing like an alien genie.
Yes. Yeah.
And Andre 3000 wearing braces.
Yeah.
And a bow tie, right? Like, both of those things are pretty squarely in my
mind. All the Andres from the Hey Ya video, all of them, like, all the different ones. Like,
and, you know, one of the things is, like, Andre's a painter and now a flautist, apparently. and, like, Andre has never been afraid to be aesthetic, like,
right,
to care about beauty. And for men particularly, I think that is often, you know, culturally a problem. And so what you end up with is these things like, you know, whether it is young Republicans talking about the roots of Ivy style and basically everything up to the line of, like, and what's great is Jews can't wear it.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
whether it's that, or, you know, there are all these different gross versions of this, you know, like all the classic style stuff. Like, it can really get very easily into, like, we're excluding people from this. Like, this is a great tool for exclusion.
It's like Roger Stone gets in the news and it's like, I like 70% of what you're wearing right now. I would take 30% of it off, but also you're a monster.
Well, I mean, Michael Anton, who was a very, very active regular in the menswear community and particularly on Style Forum and wrote a menswear book, has been a foreign policy top foreign policy advisor in the Trump administration, who, you know, who's my understanding of his primary policies are, we should just nuke everyone.
Yeah. God.
And, you know, those are not my values, but I'm also have some hesitance to get involved in the kind of values that I associate with, like, Reddit, which is a great place, and the menswear stuff on Reddit is generally pretty great. But there can sometimes be this, it's like you're comparing the specs of a sports car.
Right. Yeah.
And you're like, well, how about this? Is it pretty or is it not pretty? You know what I mean? Like, at a certain point, you can't build a system with numbers at the end for everything. And not all Goodyear welted shoes are better than all Blake welted shoes and so on and so forth. So I wanted to build something that like had something behind it, had some values, but also that included in those values, you know, beauty and the aesthetic and, you know, maybe a little cheekiness and fun.
Right. Yeah. And Put This On definitely succeeds in that.
Just putting fuck on a t-shirt, by the way.
Well, I do want to talk to you about vintage shopping because it's obviously your passion and I assume your hobby, like what you do when you're not doing everything else.
Well, yeah. I mean, I grew up going to, as I mentioned, my mom went to graduate school when I was a kid and ended up becoming a junior college professor when I was in my mid to late teens. But before that, she worked in an antique shop and throughout my life, up to and including now, she's been antiques dealer somewhere on the spectrum between part-time and full-time.
So you come by it and so honest. Like it's
I spent my teenage years on Friday and Saturday morning, Friday mornings in the summer, Saturday mornings on the weekends, you know, getting up at 6 to go wait in line at an estate sale with my mom. And going to the flea market in San Francisco and so on and so forth. And that's still a huge part of my life. So whether it's like when I'm anxious or nervous, I usually go to the thrift store.
Yeah. Yeah.
Every Sunday, unless I'm out of town, I'm at the flea market here in Los Angeles. I go to estate sales on Friday mornings when I can. I do fewer estates here than I did when I was in San Francisco, and I have a store, the Put This On shop, that I started as a way to enable all of this.
It's for the site. I have to go.
Yeah, exactly, honey. It's work. I have to go to London. But yeah, I've always, I mean, like I started buying and selling vintage clothes when I was a teenager, during the swing revival. I would buy 40s stuff, 30s and 40s stuff at the Salvation Army that was the right next to the bus stop on my way home from high school. I'd go in there every day. And that was the early days of eBay. I'd sell it on eBay or I'd take it up the street to to a vintage store on 24th Street in San Francisco called Guys and Dolls. And they would be like, where'd you get this? And I'd be like, gentleman never tells.
Yeah, I'm not giving you my source. So yeah. I also love going to flea markets and thrift stores. And I'm wondering when I go, you always see a shit ton of 1999 Phantom Menace merchandise. So I'm wondering, like, when you say vintage, just so the listeners know, are you meaning, you know, a Darth Maul inflatable chair and older, or do you go, does your definition of vintage start earlier than that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say my definition of vintage is pretty generous. Like, I think, you know, most vintage dealers would say 20 years old or more.
Oh, so Phantom Menace is right there.
So Phantom Menace is right there. And certainly in vintage clothing, the 90s is the place that is exploding. Oof, I mean, if you go to the vintage area of the Rose Bowl flea market, it's all streetwear guys buying, like, the Jay Leno Show t-shirts. It's very confusing.
It's a Matt Tonight.
It's like, not my taste. One guy one time had a Diggable Planets t-shirt, and I was like, oh, I'm going to buy this Diggable Planets t-shirt. Finally, one of these guys had something I want. And I went up and asked him how much it was, and it was $400.
Oh, my, no, see.
And I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll... I'll just give ish $400 to draw me a Diggable Planets t-shirt personally.
Exactly. LA has done a bunch of those stores that is just like old t-shirts.
Yeah.
There's just like X-Men t-shirts, Roseanne t-shirts.
Well, yeah. And there's these very specific kind. I mean, if you could find yourself an Aphex Twin t-shirt, apparently those are $1,000 a piece.
Why?
It's because some celebrity wore one who probably doesn't even like Aphex Twin. I mean, no offense, Aphex Twin's a great act.
It's like how the Joy Division logo is now everywhere and people don't even know that's a Joy Division album cover.
So that stuff is mostly not to my taste, although, you know, I probably got a dozen pairs of sneakers that aren't that far outside that line.
Right.
But, and, you know, like I said, if I ran into, man, I saw a guy wearing a Raucous Records sweatshirt the other day. And I was like, oh, yeah. If I was at the flea market and somebody told me that cost $200, I might have a hard time not buying it.
Well, what is the difference? Like, when you say, like, this, you know, band t-shirt from the 90s is $400, my instinct is go on eBay and find a reproduction. Like, so yeah. What is
the... That's very reasonable. Yeah, I certainly buy into the idea of liking something that has lived a life.
Right, exactly.
But generally speaking, when I am buying for myself...
Yeah.
There are two broad categories of things I'm buying. Oh, one is the kinds of very high-end tailored clothes that maybe I couldn't afford otherwise, or wouldn't want to afford otherwise. Right. So, like, I bought a secondhand Keaton suit.
Oh,
that I probably gave them $300 for it or something. Wow. But you know, I don't have $10,000 to buy a new Keaton suit,
and yeah,
it would be bonkers for me to buy. It's like, it's cashmere and it's brown plaid, so it's not exactly an all occasions item. It's not something I can amortize over many wears.
No, how much tailoring did you have to do? Like, did it fit you like a glove immediately, or did you have to go do work?
It fit great. I probably wouldn't have spent that money if it didn't fit great. I mean, I think maybe I had the sleeves taken down or taken up, but so that kind of stuff. And I'll buy that stuff at the thrift store, and I'll buy the occasional like an Oxford cloth shirt. That's often just a Brooks Brothers one from the thrift store, because you just see them, you know, and just those kind of fungible things that it's 10 years old, but it doesn't matter. They'll buy those things. And then, but if I'm talking about like actual vintage, it's mostly would be, I don't want to speak too broad, but largely 60s and earlier. I mean, like, the reason basically being that like manufacturing of everything except for like high-end luxury goods kind of went to shit between the late 60s and the mid 80s.
Okay.
You know, like variously, depends on what it is.
Yeah. But
for almost everything, you know, furniture, I think cars got better because they, you know, figured out how to use robots better.
There's no Model T's still running around right now. So.
Yeah. But in most categories, it was about how can we get prices down? Not how can we get quality
right,
up?
Yeah.
So, because, you know, that's what capitalism is. People want to buy a lot of things.
Yeah.
If they can. It's natural. It's inside our brains somewhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like if I'm buying old stuff, I still have a soft spot for, I mean, I don't dress like Vince Vaughn and Swingers or anything.
Well, there's a way to mix it with newer things that kind of makes it all seem timeless all in a way.
Yeah. And we keep it relatively simple and so on and so forth, you know. And that is actually kind of the casual aesthetic of put this on. It's like, hey, you know what? You might look good in blue jeans and a white t-shirt. Have you thought about that?
You know, oh, like, yeah.
How about a gray t-shirt? That's basically, I wear blue jeans and a gray t-shirt probably 3 days a week.
It's a nice uniform to have.
Oh.
That's interesting to hear about the way clothing has, you know, the means of production has deteriorated, because when I read like an Instagram like caption, it's like, and here's a suit from 1930 or like a pair of pants from 1942. My mind can't fathom that. And I just kind of assume like things have to turn to dust. Like, I can't understand like a 70-year-old shirt is still there. Like it's
yeah. I mean, my tuxedo, I bought at a thrift store. I bought it at a Goodwill in Pasadena.
Mm.
Fits me beautifully. It's from the mid 30s. And it's in perfect condition.
How does that happen?
And it's totally wearable. Like if I wore it, I have worn it to black tie things. Nobody is like, wow, that must be 100 years old. It just looks like a tuxedo. I mean, it looks like a good tuxedo.
Yeah.
Because most people are wearing garbage tuxedos. But it mostly just looks like a tuxedo.
Well, what are the noticeable differences that you see, like when you compare a tuxedo from 1930 to one in like 2019? Are there like, I don't know, can you actually like feel the improved craftsmanship, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think there's it's moves in different directions at different parts of the market, right? So I think that, like, if you went to the store and bought a polo suit right now, that is almost completely machine made. Maybe it's half canvassed or something like that.
Yeah.
But that's going to be a pretty good quality garment. Like canvassing, like the interfacing and stuff, you know, the glues they use, the adhesives they use, the technology they use to cut fabric and so on and so forth. All of that has come a long way in the last 25 years. And you get a pretty good quality suit at that point relative to that quality of suit in 1980.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Although Polo has moved mass market a little bit. So old Polo is also very, very well made. And there is still Keaton or whatever, you know what I mean? Like there's still plenty of people making, or there are still some people making things beautifully almost by hand, you know? And they are just mostly hyper luxury products and they exist alongside, you know, whatever, Dolce and Gabbana. If you go buy a Dolce and Gabbana suit, it's going to cost you a shit ton of money. Yeah. It's not going to be of particularly good quality.
Right.
It might have interesting design ideas, but it's not, the quality's not going to be.
And you can say Dolce and Gabbana.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, if you go back 50 years in American history, people had a suit of clothes.
Right.
Or they had two or three suits of clothes. Right. And those were either factory made with many more sizes than are available now. I mean, look at like Florsheim shoes had 4 foot and heel widths until the, you know, 70s.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, no idea.
and they come out of the expectation that like, you are only a generation removed from, in order to buy clothes, someone has to make them for you personally.
Yeah,
you
know what I mean? Yeah.
That even the machine-made clothes of that time are going to be relatively high quality. I mean, they're also different. Substantially, they are heavier because they had to be more durable and because there were there was a lot less heat.
Right.
And because fashion was very much dictated by the cold place that is London, England, and so on and so forth. You know, it was only in the 60s that like Italians had influence in men's fashion, particularly.
Well, and did those thick fabrics like help them, you know, last 100 years also?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it depends on what it is, you know, like gabardines get shiny. And you know, wool can get holes in it from moths.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't get holes in it from moths, it will last indefinitely. You know what I mean? Like it's not like and that's especially true of like coats and stuff. You know, pants sometimes you get wear in the crotch or on the seat. And it depends, you know, like flannel, it's all these different things, you know, like flannel has a nap, right? And the nap will wear down over time in places like the edge of the cuff,
right,
at the wrist. So one thing I learned as a 15-year-old or 16-year-old is if you buy a suit with a soft hand, but almost any, but especially one with a soft hand, secondhand, you can't expect to let down the sleeves because you're going to get a stripe of wear
across
the wrist, but you can take up the sleeves because that just, you know, brings that stripe of wear up inside the cuff. Right. So the quality has been remarkably better, but that's also true of like, you know, that's also true of furniture. It's also true of almost all the consumer goods that we touch.
Right.
And as somebody who's been going to estate sales for, I'm 37, so 30 years or so. The difference between the stuff from the 50s and 60s that was at an estate sale 20 years ago and the stuff from the 80s that's at an estate sale now,
right,
in terms of quality is pretty dramatically different. And some, you know, on the high end, there's been progression and some parts of things that are machine made have gotten better at being machine made since then. And certainly, everyone in the first world is living a much more profligate life.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot more consumer goods. But the quality of the things we have is not necessarily better.
Well, if there's like people that want to get into vintage shopping, like seriously, or I guess even casually, is there one item of clothing that you think like guys or people should be on the lookout for, like it's better to buy these things old than new, or like a good starting place?
I mean, a pea coat.
Oh yeah.
I think it's probably a good one. If you live somewhere where it gets cool, even just like I don't wear my pea coat a lot in San Francisco, and I've had the same pea coat since I was, I bought it at a garage sale when I was a teenager.
Oh, wow.
And I don't wear it a lot in Los Angeles, but I wore it a lot in San Francisco. It doesn't have to, it doesn't get super, super cold. That melton wool is more about protecting you from the elements than, you're theoretically you wear a sweater underneath it if it's really cold. But a pea coat is something where you can still buy World War II Korea era pea coats online for $50 or $75. And it's something that you really will, I mean, like, as much as people claim, oh, this is a classic, that's a classic, and pretend like it's exempt from fashion, like a peacoat is literally about as close as it gets to being an actual classic. And the quality of one that's made for somebody that was in the Navy in the 50s is so many leaps and bounds ahead of what you're going to get from Kors by Michael Kors at Macy's or whatever, you know, like
that might be the brand of my peacoat actually.
I mean, it's possible to, you know, like, it's possible to buy, like, if you want to buy a Brunello Cucinelli peacoat, yeah, it's going to be nicer than the military kind. It won't wear as hard, but it'll be nicer, but it's going to cost $7,000 or whatever, $3,000. This is like a thing where, like, if you spend $50 or $75, you'll do great. And I mean, like, this is obvious, but like jean jacket.
Oh yeah.
Like you can buy a jean jacket. Like, my kids wear jean jackets when they need a jacket much of the year, 'cause I live in Los Angeles, and you know, I just go on eBay and just buy a Lee or a Levi's one for $10.
Yeah.
And $8 to ship it to me, or $5 to ship it to me, you know, like.
Well, those are the items that, like, the more worn in they get, the better they look.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, like, I think simple things, shirts. If you know what shirt size you are, you can buy really great shirts at the thrift store. If you put in the time, you know, you're not going to be able to, you know, secondhand shopping is not the same as buying something new. You can't just walk into the store and say, give me this.
Yeah.
You have to buy what you see when you see it. But if you go through the shirts, you know, and you know what size you are, you'll find a very wearable quality business shirt, you know, once every three times you go to a thrift store, you know, like, they're out there. Buy the ones that actually fit you. And, you know, like with shirts, you know, when I'm out at the thrift store, I don't buy them because I have plenty of clothes of my own, and they, you know, I wouldn't make any money reselling them, but like Nordstrom store brand shirts, see them all day long at the thrift store, and they're good quality shirts. I mean, they're, you know, it's not like the sleeves are set in by hand, but it's nice fabric and simply styled, and yeah, go to town.
Go to town, listeners. Speaking of listeners, I have a couple of listener questions.
Yeah.
So at Winston Noel on Twitter, and I guess this is also a plug for Mission to Zix on Maximum Fun, because Winston cool. is a friend of mine, and also you can hear him on that podcast. How do you know what colors work for you other than trial and error? Like, what colors work for you and what don't?
There are two big systems for that. One is the dress for success, the 80s, you know, the seasonal thing.
Yeah.
And that woman wrote a book called Colors for Men, which, if you can abide the number of like Alex P. Keaton haircuts in it, you can buy for $1 on Amazon used, you know, probably 25 cents. And it's pretty corny, but it explains things pretty coherently. But the basic idea is, in terms of coloration, it's and they get pretty deep in terms of tones and undertones and so on. But in terms of coloration, there's basically for white people, there's like pinkish white people who are like extra pale, and then there's kind of brownish white people who are a little creamier.
Yeah.
For people with darker skin, bolder colors look better against the skin than they do for white people. And then basically, like, if you have very pale coloration, including your hair, less intense colors will look better on you. So like my wife and I are both white, but I have, like, I tan more than she does. She just sunburns right away. And I'm a couple more shades browner than she is.
Yeah.
She's a couple more shades pinker than I am. And she has pretty blonde hair and I have pretty dark hair. And I look much better in autumnal colors, colors like, you know, dark greens, right, dark reds, brown. I look good in brown, and more saturated colors. And, you know, I buy a lot of her clothes, and as in most heterosexual relationships.
It's like that's a lot of trust and, there.
Yeah. And one thing I learned very early on is that, like, if I give her like heavily saturated colors, generally speaking, they like wash out her whole face or make her face look red. Whereas if I wear the like very light colors that she wears, like the less saturated colors, you know, pale pinks, pale blues, those kinds of things, I look much worse.
Ah.
And that goes to the kind of general overarching principle besides the seasonal thing, which is Alan Flusser describes it as high contrast and low contrast.
Yes, in Dressing the Man.
Yeah, in Dressing the Man. That's like a simpler system that also works pretty well. But I mean, with color, I think a lot of people just aren't very comfortable with color in general. Mm. And if you're especially men, especially straight men who have been taught to loathe aesthetics their whole life.
To not care.
Unless it's a sports car or a cigar.
Yeah.
but you can get yourself a color wheel and learn how to use a color wheel. That is pretty straightforward. That will help your clothes complement even if it might not help you complement your clothes to your skin. And, you know, you can look at the natural world around you. Because most of the color combinations that we find pleasing, most of the palettes that we find pleasing come directly from like color palettes that exist in the actual real world. So if you look at landscape paintings, for example, you can find palettes there. And then if you can identify the kinds of palettes that suit you well, you can kind of go in that direction with your clothing. But beyond that, I mean, there is some element of trial and error. But what I would say is, like, don't be afraid to like hold something up to your face and say no. You know what I mean?
Yeah, just like, say no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost everybody looks good in a white shirt. That's the other thing.
Yeah,
almost
white shirt, black pants, we're good.
Yeah. White shirt, black pants, we're a teller at a bank.
Yeah. Or a ticket taker at a movie theater. Yeah, I had to do that.
Waiter.
Another second listener question from Ludibrium Ventus on Twitter. This is more like general philosophical. What can one who feels continually frumpy do to feel less so?
Well, for one thing, you could embrace the frump. There's a lot of great frumps out there. I mean, one of my greatest style heroes is Bruce Boyer.
Yes.
Who's a really lovely guy, has become big in the menswear community, wrote some great books about menswear recently and in the 80s and 90s. And Bruce is kind of frumpy.
Mm-hmm.
He's also like extraordinarily elegant. I don't want to suggest that, but you know, Bruce is a college professor and magazine editor.
Yeah, it's a very professorial style. A lot of like.
Yeah. And, you know, he wears a lot of soft, lumpy clothes.
Yeah, yeah.
And he looks like $1 million.
Oh, I mean, my style hero is Bob Newhart in the 70s, which I think is also very, very frumpy as well.
Yeah,
so,
totally.
Embrace it.
I would say you're allowed to embrace it. But if we're talking about like getting yourself, taking yourself from feeling like you don't look good on a day-to-day basis to feeling like you do look good on a day-to-day basis, I would say my top recommendation is to simplify your clothing dramatically.
Hmm.
So, ideally you want to find things that are flattering, that you feel like you look good in body wise and color wise. But you know, for men, things like blue jeans, gray flannel pants,
mm-hmm.
Brown corduroy pants, navy blue coats, light blue and white shirts, things that are, if you just like, almost everyone has way more clothes than they need.
Yes. Yep.
And I'm not here to preach capsule wardrobes or that you shouldn't have any expressive clothes or whatever. But I'm wearing a wax print, like an outrageous wax print shirt right now that I bought at the flea market. But I do think there's a lot to be gained from just like keep it like start by paring way back, keeping it really simple and wearing the things that you that work for you a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because and think about why they work for you when you're wearing them. Like, because the reality is that like we think we need to have extraordinary infinite variety, but we occupy a very tiny part of everyone else around us's brain.
Oh yeah.
I'm sitting here with my colleague Jordan running the board, and she's wearing a very nice like mustard colored cardigan shirt, and I couldn't, maybe she wore that yesterday, I couldn't even tell you. I could not even tell you. And it's a nice shirt. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm a professional fashion writer.
We get it stuck in our heads, like everyone is noticing me. This mistake is going to live with me forever. There's lots. Yeah. Yeah.
But also that we have to like change it up all the time.
Right.
And whatever. If something works for you, just go with it and get yourself a nice, you know, like there's a on the Reddit, male fashion board, there's this thing they joke about basic bastard, which is just like wearing like it's like Clark's desert boots and clean cut chinos and a white Oxford button down shirt.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's like, on the other hand, you could do a lot worse.
Right. Yeah. You're putting some effort together. So yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Like I think in really simple outfits, we advocate for something. There was this guy who he's not been that active in the menswear world, but his name is Ethan. He used to post as Mr. Wong, who is he lives in Australia and Hong Kong, and one of the best dressed guys I've ever seen. And he would advocate for what he called a point of distinction, and I stole that.
Oh.
So like it is a nice idea if you're dressed as simply as can be, and he would wear like a perfect blue suit and a perfect white shirt much of the time.
Yeah.
like you'd see pictures of him. He was almost always wearing that, and he always looked gorgeous.
It's a uniform. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice. But he would also have some distinctive element, you know, like a nice pair of sunglasses or something like that. And I think something that expresses who you are is a nice compliment to that kind of thing. Especially a modest thing like that, you know, right. It doesn't have to be that outrageous.
Awesome. Well, that's all the listener questions. So I just have one more thing to draw out of you, I guess. That's a weird way of putting ask a question.
It's a blood sample. I like to ask every guest if they have kidney disease.
They can spit into this cup.
Yeah,
I'm sponsored by 23andMe.
Oh, great. You're going to find out what dog breed I am.
Right. So at the end of every episode, I like to ask guests for a challenge or some like actionable advice they can give me and also the listeners that we can go actually like do out in the world.
How about make one public thing?
Oh.
A creative thing. It doesn't. I mean, when I say a creative thing, it doesn't have to be fine art.
Right, right, right.
But whatever your interest is, whether you're whether you love to bake or you love to whatever it is, make one thing and that you know is going to be public.
Oh.
Whether that public can really just be everyone you know on Facebook or whatever.
Right. And
you don't have to get it perfect. I'm not asking you to make one perfect thing. I'm just asking you to make one thing. So like if there's an essay you've been meaning to write, just write that shit and then, you know, go over it. Do make it as good as you can. I know for me, I'm so embarrassed anytime I'm making anything public that I have to work hard on it.
Right, yeah.
But like whatever it is, I don't care if it's pictures of your model train layout or a new type of bourbon and cigar combination you just invented.
On your yacht that you just built or whatever.
Yeah. It's dry docked at your country club.
I like that.
Yeah, but whatever it might be, whatever your lane is, give it a try. And if you want like a fashion thing, wear an outfit with something old in it.
Oh, okay.
So that means like 40 plus years.
Oh, wow. 40 plus. So no, my Darth Maul suit is not cutting it.
No, you can't just, no, that doesn't count. No,
I don't have a Darth Maul suit.
None of your childhood Halloween costumes count in this case.
I did just buy a vintage X-Men tie from this 25 years old. So,
wow, we're doing novelty ties now? Is that what's going on?
It was my own personal challenge to try and see if I could take the gross novelty ties of the 90s and make it fashion. And what I found is I bought a child's tie because they are skinnier being like a 3-inch width, because in the 90s all those ties were like 5 or 6 inches wide, which to me that is the most egregious thing a tie can be, is like just really, really wide.
Yeah, I mean, cross colors and Koogie sweaters are back, but I don't know about Looney Tunes ties.
Your
Jerry Garcia brand tie is maybe not gonna come back, even with all the.
I also bought a vintage Dick Van Dyke Show watch that Nick at Night put out in 1994.
Wow, I just immediately thought, I was like, from the 60s? That sounds kind of neat.
No, but it does. It does look it. It has a nice like brown leather band. It has like a gold face. And it's really nice. I don't know. I also don't really know much about watches. I'm learning about watches through this podcast. So this was my step into, dip my toes into the watch waters, was buying a Dick Van Dyke watch.
Wow.
Well,
I mean, I bought two. I couldn't decide between the Snoopy watches. So I bought a Snoopy watch and a Charlie Brown watch.
From when? How old are they?
Like, no, new.
Oh, okay, so...
Yeah, from the Timex company. They were not cheap either. They were like $50 a piece or something. I really couldn't decide because here's the thing. The honest truth is I like Charlie Brown better because he's such a pathetic dope.
He's a frumpy icon.
Yeah, but then Snoopy had a baseball bat and I really like baseball. Snoopy was headed to play baseball. So I chose one of each.
Timex knew you were coming.
Yeah,
they had me
figured.
Thank you so much for coming on. Where can people, I don't know, check out everything that you're doing or say hello?
Well, I think listeners to this will probably enjoy Put This On at putthison.com, where they can read many, many years of writing about menswear. And if you're looking for a gift for yourself or somebody, the Put This On shop is at putthisonshop.com. And we have not just vintage clothes, in fact, mostly not vintage clothes, although we do have some vintage clothes. But lots of jewelry and accessories, which I am a big advocate for men.
And you're making your own pocket squares.
We make our own pocket squares. We make our own hats, caps, and scarves, all made by hand to the highest standards. And like the actual highest standards. That's not bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
And lots of beautiful and fun things for, you know, $17 and things for $800. You know, if you need a beautiful gold dress set from the Edwardian era, I'm your man. But I also, you can also buy a birthday present for your uncle.
Thanks again to Jesse Thorne for teaching me that a shirt will not crumble into dust once it hits 50 years old, unless there's an Infinity Gauntlet involved. So everyone, please do the challenge. Make something you love and share it publicly, or add something that is over 40 years old to your outfit. Follow the podcast on Instagram at EnlightenMyLoafers and use the hashtag ChallengeMyLoafers if you feel so inclined. Go on and send in questions for guests and me via email, EnlightenMyLoafers@gmail.com, or via DMs on Instagram. This podcast was edited by me, produced by Benjamin Raghib, graphic design by Dylan Phelps, photo by Sam Walker, and I want to thank Martin Freeman for inspiring me to buy the green suit that you see in the podcast art and that I will talk about in probably every single episode of this podcast, because I am that basic. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get podcasts, and let me know where you get your podcasts so my producer can make sure that you get the podcasts where you like your podcasts. I'll be back next week where I'll have even more questions and get even more answers on Enlighten My Loafers.